Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Hello, it's another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Today our guest is James Davis, one of my favorite educators, a good guy, and all-around smart human being. How you doing there, James?
I'm doing awesome. Just psyched to rap with you for a little bit and talk liberty.
Cool. Tell me a little bit about your past journey in life and in liberty, and then we'll talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah, well...
Tell the listeners what you do now.
Okay, that makes more sense. I run a children's summer camp and a year-round retreat center, but you know the main focus is on working with the kids.
You're working with the kids. Cool. Mm-hmm. In like in a think of the children kind of way, like you know, steal lots of tax money, all that, make lots of laws.
Yeah, no, we work on strictly on a voluntary interaction basis. We don't collect any government money, although we are a non-for-profit, so we happily don't pay any taxes either. But we are strictly voluntary.
Yeah, I've done one project as a nonprofit, which is different than a not-for-profit, but it's in the same page, literally, on the tax code. My first movie, I did through a 501c3 umbrella group. And, you know, people have actually taken me to task for that. Like, well, you're a libertarian, but you're working with the government. And I'm like, I'm working with the government to not give money I shouldn't give to the government.
Yeah, it's like if a bully was going to beat me up and I asked him permission to not beat me up, I don't think that makes me a hypocrite. It just says, will you please not beat me up? And if he says yes, more power to me, I think.
Yep. So tell me a little bit about your camp.
Well, I think the biggest thing about my camp is basically we try to run it through the non-aggression principle. Now, it is a Christian-themed camp, which is actually a really big asset to us because, you know, Jesus had a really big-time perspective on not using aggression against other people. And now a lot of people don't interpret his messages that way, but it's a really easy sell when you're bringing people in to talk about, you know, giving people freedom of choice over activities and freedom of association and all sorts of things like that when you can cast it through this lens that's really important to them. And so, yeah, it's basically we don't have very many rules at the camp, and the ones we do are structured around not taking other people's stuff, not hurting other people, and not using emotional aggression against them either, so teasing, bullying, things like that.
What's the name of the camp, and where is it?
It's called the Vander Camp Center. It's in upstate New York near Syracuse.
Huh. Are you a Christian?
Yeah, well, I was raised in the Christian faith. You know, my mother was actually a Presbyterian minister. I got pretty disconnected from it for a while. And then, you know, when I wanted to get back into camping, so these ideas that we share about how people should be treated aren't very common. And so a lot of people I discussed these ideas with when I was interviewing were sort of nonplussed by the ideas of, you know, treating kids as equals and things like that. So this Christian summer camp was the one that, you know, I was able to sell, essentially.
I was raised Presbyterian, too. I didn't know we had that in common.
Well. What do you know?
Yeah, it was... this is an interesting story about my mother, who passed away from cancer about 12, 15 years ago. People said probably like, you should know exactly when your mother passed away. I don't know, man. The years just spin by for me. And my daughter, passed away in 2006, and that weighed a lot heavier on my head. So,
I imagine.
Yeah, my only kid from cancer. But... my mother, and this is something that happened before I was born with my older sisters, I really like this story, was they used to go to a Baptist church, and my dad was a Baptist Sunday school teacher. And one day, my mother overheard the, what do they have in Baptists? Preacher? Pastor? The pastor?
Yeah, probably a pastor.
Heard the pastor telling my little sister, who was like six, this is before I was born, you know, they missed church for about 3 weeks for some reason, farming or something. Right. They were farming, I think. And the pastor said to my little sister, you know, little girls who miss church get thrown into the eternal lake of fire. And my mother heard that, ran across the room, said to him, God is a loving God. You're not going to speak to a child that way. Jesus loved the little children. We're leaving your church. Grab the kids. And like drove across town and joined the Presbyterian church that day.
Yeah, well, and that's, I think, you know, like, so Christian messages, just like anything, right? So, I mean, you think about the Libertarian Party and what that looks like now, or like the Tea Party movement. A lot of things start with really good ideas and then let themselves be run roughshod by people with really bad ideas who know that they have a captive audience, you know? So I think that's definitely the current state of the Christian message in this day and age.
I love that my mother did that. She was really stern, and I have a lot of issues with how my parents raised me, but I like that story about her, because in 1960, that was a pretty bold thing for a woman to do. You know, that was not a woman's place to do that in 1960, and she did it anyway.
Oh, totally. I always think about that in terms of, you know, when I discuss things with my parents and how they raised me, like a lot of the things they did, I wouldn't do, but on the same token, they were forward thinking for their time. And, you know, I remember finding letters that my grandfather wrote, and he was actually engaged to a woman that turned out to be a lesbian, and he wrote down in that, in his journal, he was like, "So I think she's a lesbian. I know that's supposed to be really bad, but I'm not so sure about that." And so, you know, someone today is saying something like that, you'd be like, "Oh, what a bigot," you know, but for his time, he was like the most radical forward thinker ever. So it's just all about when you live. You know?
When I was a kid, my ultra conservative dad said at one point, "You know, I've come to the conclusion that homosexuals shouldn't be put in jail. They're just sick," which for him was forward thinking for that time.
Yeah, right. And I think that's what I'm trying to go with the whole bringing peace to kids thing, because I think as we look throughout history, you know, like women were mistreated and not allowed to vote until whatever the 19 teens, and then black people were mistreated for another 45 years, and you could argue they still are, and then gay people continue to be mistreated, and I think the very, very last people we'll get to are kids, because they just don't have a voice, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of efforts to help them seem to hurt them. You know, the first state that had women's voting was Wyoming, where I live.
Yeah, right.
What they say here is a half joke, but it's half serious too. Is it was so some of them would move here.
Yeah,
because it was.
Well, and that's the free market at work, right?
Yeah.
When you give people more freedoms, they want to come live with you and hang out with you, and that's why, you know, our camp is thriving right now against all odds, because I think the kids that came here were like, "Hey, you know, I felt something different there." Now, they wouldn't put a finger on that it's freedom, but that largely is what our main offering is, you know.
What do you think of I kind of feel like I'm not Christian, but I was raised Christian. I went to an all boys boarding school that was Christian. Right. I don't know if I told you about that or not. I actually ended up in the hospital for a week from a hazing in that school, and two kids got kicked out for it. Yeah. there's not a very Christian message. And was born again Christian for a while, and have studied the Bible, and have a soft spot in my heart for Christians. I'm basically a deist. You know what that is?
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm absolutely sure there's a God, and I don't know his phone number, basically, is what it comes down to. What do you think of how the message of Jesus is being co-opted into a message of socialism? And, you know, like Jesus said things that were basically saying, be generous. And people take that to, we're going to point guns at your head and make you be generous. And also,
oh, this is so funny. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, don't let me cut you off. Sorry.
Well, that's part one of the question. Part two is, and Jesus being portrayed as, you know, a pacifist who wanted his followers to curl up in a ball when attacked physically or in any other way. I mean, two things that come to mind are, one is, you know, overturning the tables of the money changers is not a gentle act. And, yeah, you know, saying sell your coat to buy a sword is a thing quoted by a lot of gun owners as justification for, you know, self-defense.
Yeah, well, let's start with the socialist piece. I was actually, when I first got here, I found because, you know, I'm a peace-oriented person, you know. I think people should live their lives peacefully. But, you know, I do believe that retaliatory force is totally within reason if you have demonstrable proof that someone's attacking you. You know, like, I don't consider our efforts in Iraq to be a retaliatory force, obviously. But so I went to this, I found a peace-centered Bible study group around here when I got here, and I wanted to make a connection with them on behalf of the camp. And so I attended their group, and it was really interesting because the guy who leads the group is this brilliant scholar of Christianity. His name's Tony Bartlett, and he was doing a study on the book of Luke, which is where most of that Jesus is a socialist vibe comes from. And so he gets into one point where Jesus is saying, you know, basically give away all your stuff, you know. And the guy's wife at the time was like, Yeah, and this is what always drives me crazy when people complain about paying their taxes, because I'm happy to pay my taxes. You know, it helps the little kids and the welfare moms and all that stuff. And then this guy responded by saying, yeah, it's funny. Most people don't realize that Jesus is a socialist. And this is my first time with these groups. And, you know, they're mostly in their 60s. And I'm basically there to, you know, meet people, but also to hopefully bring them in sales almost. And I say, all right, let's stop right here, because Jesus is not a socialist. He's good with the sharing part, but not the stealing part. And that's the thing people always forget, is that, you know, everyone who doesn't want to give stuff away to poor people. I don't know many people who disagree with that. But where I come in is, like, when you have to go and rip it out of the hands of unwilling parties, I don't think you find too much of that in Jesus's messages in the Bible that I've read, anyway.
Yeah, I think there is no moral obligation to give your things away, but I like to help people with time and money. I mean, I read Atlas Shrugged when I was 14, and I dug the message of it, of, yeah, you shouldn't have to give everything you make away or any of it. It's all yours. You earned it. You produce jobs. But I also really did not resonate with the coldness of that. You know, I agree that you don't have any moral obligation to, you know, help out the underfortunate, but I feel that Ayn Rand would have rather, you know, what's that saying, crapped on a freshly baked pie than not share it with anybody, share it with anybody not of her tribe.
Yeah, right. And I think when you talk about sharing, you know, my whole thing is, and when I talk about, you know, people trying to live closer to the messages of Jesus and things like that, it mostly comes down to the fact that it can make you happier right now. Like, I think giving things away is a sort of a selfish thing. It'll make you feel really good to observe the people you help. And I think just gathering stuff and kind of like, because, I mean, I basically live my life that way, playing poker professionally. That's just what you are doing. You are just making money and nothing else.
To be clear, like, you're not doing that now while running a children's camp. You used to do that.
No, I don't do it anymore.
Not that there'd be anything wrong with that. Right.
But yeah, it's mostly because the climate changed due to draconian enforcement from the U.S. government, which I don't know how up you are on the online poker legislation scene.
Nima's dad used to do it for a living, and he's disabled and, you know, can't do it anymore. And I said that he should do a lawsuit against the Department of Justice under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because he can't drive to Vegas, you know?
Mm. Yeah, well, and a lot of people, I mean, myself included, just had massive amounts of earning power just taken right out from under us. I mean, the way the culture changed as they progressively got worse was really, really striking. And by the way, most of the money we were winning was coming into the country from other countries too, and getting poured back into the U.S. economy. And the fact that they wouldn't let U.S. companies run the casinos was obviously making the majority of money go out of the country to Costa Rica and England and places like that. But yeah, anyway, that's a total another disaster. We can get into it if you want, but that might actually get me worked up too. So
I could talk about that all day, but let's talk more about Jesus overturning the tables of the early central banks.
Yeah, right. Well, there's two main pieces that I think people look to when it comes to Jesus's messages in terms of what you should do. So, like, on one hand, he says, you know, someone comes to him and says, hey, Jesus, what about paying our taxes? Should we do that? And he says, you know, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, basically, right? He says, whose picture is on the coin? Okay, well, it's his. Then give it to him. And I mean, I disagree.
Yeah, I've seen Christian on libertarian forums, I have seen, you know, 60 pages of discussion on that particular passage.
Yeah. Well, my thing is too, like, so Jesus is this guy who's obviously pretty influential, but I'm not 100% convinced that he was always quoted accurately. I'm not always convinced that, you know, his messages were portrayed the way they ought to have been, you know, based on who translated the books.
Well, and you know, where the early church took it. I mean, if you look at some of the Middle Ages and Renaissance period Catholic Church, the people running the church, including the popes, some of the popes, you know, they were so violent and oppressive and power hungry. You know, they made the Sopranos look like Quakers.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's why, you know, looking at the Bible in a literalist perspective is supremely outdated. And, you know, basically, I mean, I run in circles with a lot of pastors now through this camp, and almost none of them interpret the Bible in a literal way. So I think that, you know, pointing to any specific quote can get you into trouble. But You know, it's my thing is you get to know someone, you know the gist of what they say. Like, I haven't heard your opinion on every single libertarian issue, but if someone were to come to me and say, what do you think Michael Dean thinks about subsidized corn? I would have a pretty good idea as to what you think about it, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's the same thing with Jesus. You know, he's like this dude who, you know, loves everyone and wants them to share, doesn't want them to steal or kill each other. And so you can kind of go from there. But like, so as far as Jesus being a pacifist, he did say turn the other cheek, right? But he also said to use your God-given abilities to the best of your ability. So if someone's going to come and murder me, I think I can do a better job for the world by taking that person out of my way and continuing to help the world instead of letting this murderer run roughshod over everyone just because I don't happen to want to fight back, you know?
I had a real, recently I had a real kind of like funny revelation about one of my early kind of Christian, I guess I'd say heroes. When I was 14 and in the church farm school in Paoli, Pennsylvania, the priest there was really hip. He was one of those like, hey, rap with me, relate with me kind of priests. Like he took us to see the band Yes. And, you know, he understood that I was a conscientious objector and had me write a letter to him to keep on file in case I got drafted someday. I could show it wasn't just a recent convenience thing. And I was thinking about him the other day and I looked him up on the internet. I was like, wonder what he's doing now. And the first thing that pops up is a picture of him with his arm around Barack Obama.
Wow.
Like it, with this, you know, Obama endorsing this, like, think of the children and steal money to help them program that this priest was running. I was like, yep, there you go. That's the socialist misinterpretation.
Yeah. And that's the real shame is that I think that most people, like I often think about the fact that things just become the default. And so, you know, why I kind of empathize with Democrats to some degree is they're operating under the assumption, like, given that people are going to steal money anyway, maybe we should use it more to like help poor people and build schools. And I'm like, okay, well, if you're going to steal money anyway, I'd prefer you spend it on that instead of blowing up brown people other places. But they just
Democrats are really really into blowing up brown people these days.
Yeah, touche. You
know, the most ironic thing to me is that, you know, our first African-American, I guess he's American-African, because he, right. You know, our first brown president was, you know, the first president in a long time to bomb a bunch of people in Africa and kill a bunch of civilians, you know?
Oh, I know it. And it's actually really interesting to me because I met a guy who worked for me for a few weeks last summer, is this Kenyan guy, and he actually is from an area right near where Barack Obama's dad is from, I guess. I'm not an Obama scholar, but so anyway, my friend Samuel has met Obama and he actually approached him and was talking to him about bombing Libya and, you know, basically just had a candid conversation with him about it for like, you know, a half an hour at some point whenever that happened, I don't know. And he claims that, and of course, who knows how much of this is true, but he claims that Obama was very apologetic to him and thought he was going to like reconsider it and all this nonsense. And of course, he just went right back and never made any such claim in the public arena. But
yeah, I think Reagan was the last guy to be heavily bombing Libya, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, and that's why, you know, I'm actually really excited about Obama because, so to give you background, I attended Barack Obama's inauguration. So this is how quickly I've changed my mind on all this stuff.
I considered voting for Obama, you know, when he first announced. And so I was about 6 months ahead of you, I think is what I'm saying.
Yeah, right.
I'm not Nemo's born anarchist, I think, but.
Right. Well, and I, you know, so I got this guy and he's like hope and change and he's like this really good speaker and slick talker and he's black, which I thought was cool, mostly because I was like, hey, maybe America's not as racist as we used to be. But then what ultimately brought me to Liberty was I was just so supremely disappointed by just one thing after another. And I talked to my friend Justin Longo, who, you know, is our mutual Facebook friend anyway. And he's been hip on these ideas for a long time. And then my brother, who's actually a Buddhist but also an anarcho-capitalist, was talking to me about this stuff too. And I was like, you dudes are right. You know, the government can't solve anything. If Barack Obama can't do it or is unwilling to do it or whatever, then who will be, you know? So
that kind of occurred to me too. You know, like, I mean, like a lot of white Americans who came from, I wouldn't say privilege, but, you know, never missed a meal in a day in my life. You know, had to work a lot, but, you know, never was starving, never was way below the poverty line or anything like that, except by choice when I was playing in a rock band. and, you know, putting all my money into my arm. Obama, you know, to me, like I've said in my life in past decades, like these old fat white people, you know, like complained about like white people being the problem. Like, you know, I mean, when Cheney came along, I was like, he's the ultimate of what I've thought of these guys forever.
yeah, no doubt.
You know, and then Obama is cool and mellow and brown and like, you know, looks like someone you might want to have a beer with. And he is, you know, beneath the slick, hey, it's all cool, everybody. You know, he's Cheney. I mean, he wants to blow up brown people. He wants to take your internet. He wants to take your bong. You know, he wants to practically make you have a license to have free speech and, you know, have to keep your guns in the local armory and just take them out once a year to go hunting or something. He would love that.
Oh, definitely. Well, yeah, he's extraditing people from other countries for running businesses that are legal in their countries, in the case of online poker. He's a really, really pretty awful guy. Or he's just a coward, you know? So it's either one or the other. Like, so someone, I think you guys were talking about when he was signing off on the Defense Authorization Act, and he was like, I do this with a heavy heart, you know? And I'm like, well, just don't be a coward.
Just don't put
your name on the paper. I don't care about the political ramifications. At some point, if someone asked me, write your name on this paper, like, or else, I would just say, no thanks. I'm just not going to do it, you know?
I think it might be just like he got drunk with power once he got the job. Like, he may have meant well at some point. Although, looking at some of his past statements, I think he's always been a socialist who, you know, socialist sociopath who wanted to rule the world. But, you know, maybe he was hip and then they handed him the keys to the military and he went, I am God. I am the destroyer. I am Shiva, you know? Sure. Anyway, let's get off that topic. I'm going to save this file.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So one of the important people in, to some people, in the development of the theories of child rearing and schooling was this guy named Wilhelm Reich, who was this Austrian researcher who was a contemporary of Freud and they may have influenced each other. And his basic theory boiled down to that all human misery from, you know, stubbed toes to world wars come down to sexually repressing children. I've always thought that was an interesting theory, but whenever anybody's got a catch-all theory, I think that it's really seeing the small picture and being problematic, you know, trying to put things in a box that can't be because they're too complex of a system. But personally, I think much of the human misery in the world comes from ignoring the non-aggression principle and from governments.
I totally agree.
Am I oversimplifying? What do you think? What do you think causes the hassles in the world?
Well, I often think about it in terms of how we, well, of course I think about it this way, but it starts with how we interact with kids, right? And I think basically from the very young age, kids learn that there is a hierarchy where some people are the boss and some people are the serfs or the slaves or whatever, and that the whole human experience is structured around trying to become the boss or suck up to the boss and hold the gun and be the one pointing it instead of being the one having it pointed at you. And I think that
or if you're anti-gun, be the guy controlling the people with the guns.
Oh, exactly. And so basically you learn this lesson from a very young age. It's instilled in you by your parents, you know, who will probably, if not openly mistreat you, like probably most parents do, they'll at least, because I said so you, and, you know, teach you all these really unintended consequences because occasionally they're too tired or lazy to deal with you peacefully. And then it's usually that's not too bad in my experience. Usually it's right around, and even kindergarten's pretty good, but right around late elementary school, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, that's when kids really start to flip a switch. And, you know, there's very few instances of bullying before those age. There's very few instances of kids stealing from each other, you know. And then over time they learn, okay, well, the teachers are the ultimate bully. I can bully these people. And then they become 18 and they're, you know, trying to bully more. And then by the time they're 35, they don't just want to bully individuals. They want to bully whole people so they can get new parks and schools or new guns or whatever. So I really do think it starts with, you know, oppressing kids, just teaching them the government paradigm, you know.
Are you familiar with Stefan Molyneux?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Do you like his stuff?
Yeah, I do, actually. I like his, he does a peaceful parenting series, or philosophical parenting series, sorry. on YouTube that's really good for people to check out.
Yeah, I'm going to turn him on to you. I'm going to send him this interview. Maybe we could hook you two up and have you do a talk somewhere on the internet.
Yeah, that'd be cool, because Stefan is actually one guy who's really, really resonates with me. I mean, obviously, like, his anti-spanking stuff is really good. And it still blows my mind. Like, I don't know, do you listen to Free Talk Live much?
Constantly.
Okay, so, like, have you heard Mark on there talk about, you know, how he's just not sure about spanking? I mean, he says he doesn't spank his own kid, but he's like, you know, I don't know. There are parents out there who make a convincing case.
Yeah, and I'm, like, and I'm interviewing him on Thursday, if you think I should ask him about that.
Yes, please do, and tell him, he has no clue who I am, but basically...
He will.
It's shocking to me that any person who could say they come from a principled, pro-liberty mindset would argue for the use of physical violence against anyone. Doesn't matter what your excuse is. I mean, it's right back to the old doesn't matter who's picking the cotton thing. Like, you know, you can keep your kid safe. You know, if you're worried about your kid walking in the street, you just stand by your kid. You don't say, oh, well, I'm going to teach him not to walk in the street by hitting him, you know, so he's scared if he walks towards the street. That's just Pavlovian, you know, that's just totally insane. And once you start doing that, you're basically saying, I'm too lazy to observe this kid as much as he needs to be observed to be dealt with peacefully. I'm going to try and take these violent shortcuts to cut out my responsibility as a parent because, you know, I had this kid for selfish reasons because I thought it would be cool and I wanted more kid stuff, you know, and now I'm unwilling to own up to my end of the agreement and that it's a kind of 24/7 responsibility. And I think it's just completely insane that anyone could argue for spanking and claim to be pro-liberty, but one man's opinion.
I agree. What do you think about parents who put their kids on those harness leases?
Well, it makes me laugh.
Me too.
It sort of makes me feel like I'm, you know, observing a glimpse of the dystopian future or something. I sort of get it in some cases, but like I compare it to my dog. So my dog, I only walk him off leash, not because I'm like pro-liberty for dogs, but just because it's a hassle to walk him on the leash. And we live on 850 acres, so there's no reason to. But when I try to walk him on the leash, he's just like tearing all around and ripping my arm out of my socket. And I think kids are the same way. Like, I think you can teach a kid to walk on a leash, but kids are not meant to walk on leashes. So, and I think, once again, the subconscious, unintended consequence of doing that are pretty dire, you know, like just this image of
you're my pet being
dragged around on a leash. Yeah. Yeah, it's so weird. It's so weird.
Yeah. Huh. So what do you do at your camp that's good and different from what's done in a lot of child, I don't know if rearing is the term, but a lot of, you know, child places you put your kids kind of places?
Well, I can paint a little bit of a picture of the things that are different. So the first thing is they get there on Sunday and I immediately tell them, you know, we sit down, we have a campfire, we sing songs and we go crazy. And then I tell them, all right, here's what you need to do. You need to observe how this week goes, you know. This is what the world could be like if everyone were trying to bring peace and non-aggression to the whole world, you know. So keep an eye out for the way people talk to each other, the way people treat each other, the way all the counselors and the way myself engage with you. Keep an eye on that and understand that it could be possible to have a whole world exactly like this. The only reason we don't is because there's too many of the people on the other side. But if you like this, if this feels good for you, then you need to bring that sort of spirit to the outside world. And I want you to observe, you know, what's different and come to me and talk to me about it. So right away, I try to cast them through the lens of, you know, it's not, I don't want to call it libpair because it's not a totally libertarian paradise, but, you know, trying to give them a sense of this is what it could be like if everyone abided by the non-aggression principle, basically. And I tell them.
Do you use that term kids and or in the literature for the place?
I don't know if I've used it in any of the literature, but I do use that term and I use it through what we call basically the no discount policy, which is basically that we want to have everyone have their full value, you know, so you don't take someone's stuff. You don't take away someone's self-esteem by teasing them or bullying them. You don't take away their physical well-being by harming them physically. And you don't put yourself down either. You know, that's kind of where we come from. We just don't want to be operating in that negative mind space when we're there. And then I say basically,
go ahead.
I was going to say, and then, you know, everything else, if you're not going to hurt yourself, if you're not going to hurt anybody else, and you're not going to do something that would like horrify your parents, like, you know, get pregnant or something, as long as you're not doing those things, then most everything else is fair game.
What ages do you have there?
We operate from 6 through 17.
And you and your wife run it?
I run it mostly myself. I mean, my wife and I consult on all the philosophical things, but she's a stay-at-home mom, so she doesn't really have time to be out there in the trenches. And then my younger brother is the other person who consults me on a lot of the philosophical thing and helps me establish the, you know, the theme for the summer and, you know, interacts with the counselors and teaches them these principles too.
How many kids do you have per year or per season?
Well, last year it was about 50 kids per week. And then actually this year, it's really crazy. We are currently enrolled at a higher rate than we were at the beginning of last summer. So we have more kids signed up as of today than we did as of July 5th last summer. So it could be much bigger than that. Who knows?
Have you ever had to send a kid home early for violence or, I mean, aggression? What do you do when someone violates the non-aggression principle and won't stop?
Yeah, well, then that's actually the one instance where we'll send someone home. So last summer, you know, the other thing that we practice is like radical engagement of the kids. Like a lot of people call it supervision, but that really is kind of has a central planning, big brother government sort of feel. So we try to term it in terms of radical engagement. So myself, like I don't take breaks or do any office work when kids are doing activities. Like I'm always out there with them, and my counselors are mandated to constantly be involved and engage with the kids. So we don't really have kids violating this almost ever, even in terms of just being rude to people and stuff. But it did happen once last summer. There was a one young kid who was physically aggressive towards another kid. I tried to mediate the situation between them. It happened again. And in that case, you know, that person is just not a safe person to have in the community anymore. So he did have to go home. But that was the only case last summer.
Do you have plans to open a school ever?
Yeah, definitely. My ultimate dream scenario, that's actually what my wife and I looked into before we came up to the camp, because that's really where our passion lies.
Is there like less paperwork with a camp?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's considerable paperwork, but the thing is, when you already have a camp in place, there's a lot. You don't have to go through too many hoops to keep it open. I mean, I get a 25-page packet from the health department every year that I have to go line by line and fill out. And it's really insane. And even my health department rep, when she came out to meet with me last year, was, you know, insinuating that sometimes they seem to write rules just to make rules. But so there is red tape, but schools are just completely insane. I mean, especially in New York. I don't know if it was like this when you were here, but
yeah, I grew up in New York State, and my sister is a retired educator, not too far from you in Ithaca.
Oh, okay. So you know about like the Regents and things like that, which are basically.
I took them.
Standardized tests for every single subject. It's the craziest thing. Oh, it really is nuts. But yeah, so we looked into starting a school, but it's a twofold thing. You need a ton of money, and we had some money, and from my poker playing friends, like we probably could have drummed up the money, but it would have been very risky, and we didn't totally know what our opinion on it was when we got to this camp. And actually our philosophies on engaging kids has radically changed since we got here too. Like, we used to be sort of in the mindset of, you know, you kind of force kids to learn the mandatory subjects, but, you know, you let them choose more, like kind of just like a better version of public school. But now we're totally off board on that. And I would love to have the camp be a school year round, you know, and that would just be my wildest fantasy, basically, to be able to do that.
Yeah, a lot of, I don't know about a lot of private school, but the private school that I went to was just better public school. There was nothing different in their methodology except that they had religion in it. And that wasn't really, we went to church four times a week, but, you know, in the classroom, if it wasn't a theology class, which was optional, you know, it was just like public school, except the classes were slightly smaller. The teachers were slightly smarter. You know, they could spank you and did, but, other than that, it was pretty much just, you know, kids sitting in a row, 6 hours a day, 7 hours a day, you know, showing up at the same place at the same time, being told what to memorize.
Oh yeah. And I think that's 100% my observation too, is basically that the way schools are run these days. Okay. So compare it to another industry. Like, is it possible to fly an airplane the way the Wright brothers did? Yeah. You know, they managed it, but it's not the best way, you know? And so these current public schools, they run in certain ways. And is it possible to educate a kid in that model? Yeah. You know, I turned out okay, as they say. Who knows what I could have been in a free learning environment, but it's not so much that it's not possible to have a decent education there. It's that the likelihood of having one is so far down, and all the unintended lessons you learn are so damaging in my mind that it's completely not worth it. And so private school has all the same conundrums, just like you said. They run a much slicker version of what is ostensibly just a completely awful model.
Yeah, my big problems with it, other than the entrenchment of teachers through unions to where they can't, well, the whole thing's funded by theft. That's my biggest problem with it. My second biggest problem with it is you can't fire bad teachers easily. And my other problem with it is just the whole model of it is based on, you know, having kids show up at the same place at the same time and sit in neat little rows and memorize stuff and learn to be compliant is based on teaching kids to work in factories, you know, 100 and some years ago. And oh, exactly. That's not what most people hopefully are going to end up doing these days. You know, I mean, I really picture if I were going to start a school, it would be a round table with kids sitting at laptops, you know, looking at Khan Academy with some sort of docent, not even a teacher, who can just answer questions and computer questions for them. I don't know.
Well, and that's even if you wanted to teach them stuff, you know, like my peer version of a school would be something like, you just have a super nutrient-rich environment where you have a table with computers, but you don't have to sit at it, you know, mm-hmm. or you have all these things and you have really engaged, smart people there to, you know, demonstrate passion for what we consider to be worthwhile pursuits, I guess. But if a kid comes to you and says, you know what I'm really interested in? Pokemon. Then you engage them in Pokemon or whatever the thing is, because the fact of the matter is, people are ultimately going to pursue what interests them at some point in their life. I mean, you can beat them down and have them slave away in a cubicle somewhere for their whole life. That is possible. And then they can reflect back when they retire and they're 65 and they've got $120,000 for retirement or something, you know, and yay, you gave away your whole life for that. But ultimately, most people will pursue what they want to do. So they can practice learning the right things to pursue when they're 9, or they can practice learning the right things to pursue in college, or when they're 25 or 35 or whenever they move out of mom's basement, you know. But yeah, I just don't get the forced learning model. Just is a complete failure in so many cases. I don't know what the push is.
Yeah, another problem with it that I forgot to bring up was the one size fits all. I was really smart and really bored. My dad's 90 and he actually grew up in a one room schoolhouse and mm-hmm. kind of had the option to sit in with the older kids when he'd mastered something at one level. And he graduated at 15 and got a job because of it.
Right.
You know, I learned a lot from the Boy Scouts. I mean, I have a lot of problems with them. They're homophobic. They're basically a soldier machine, or that's what they were originally. right. But as far as, you know, I mean, I think I learned everything I was going to learn in school that it was useful in later life by like sixth or seventh grade. You know, I mean, I could write a compelling paragraph by the seventh grade. I could do basic math. You know, I could find my country on a map. And at that point, if you just stuck me in front of a computer and let me do what I wanted to do, I think I'd be actually making more money and doing more interesting things than, you know, and I make pretty good money and do interesting things now. But I think that high school totally held me back. It totally didn't teach me social skills. It taught me to, you know, duck or feel oppressed. And they do. Old folks say things like, well, that kind of stuff gives you character. You know, I was given a hazing at my school that put me in the hospital for a week, and two kids got kicked out for it. If it happened today, they probably would have had criminal charges brought against them.
I
was scalded on my ass with boiling water.
Wow.
That was my hazing.
Jeez.
You know, while being hung on a hook as a wedgie. You know, that didn't teach me any character. It actually introduced me to narcotics, and I was like in extreme pain and afraid, and they gave me a shot of Demerol in the hospital, and I was like, I've wanted to feel this way my whole life. And I ended up being a heroin addict for about 10 years in my 20s. So I can't blame it on that, but you know, it was an introduction to something that I might not have ever had otherwise.
Oh, definitely. Well, and let's address the whole we need to prepare people for the real world argument, because this is something that, you know, my wife and I don't spend a lot of time in like negativity, but the one thing we mock all the time is like, oh, we got to prepare people for the real world. So here's the thing. The real world, when you get out of college, is you deciding something for yourself and you do it, or get out of high school or whatever. But this mentality where you got to things in life are going to be bad, so you got to do bad stuff in order to practice. Like, yeah, if life has to suck and life has to be awful, then you probably should go to school and practice life being terrible, because, you know, it would be really awful to have a great life for 18 years and then sit in a cubicle for 50 years after that. But that doesn't have to be what the real world is. Like, people like you are doing creative stuff. Like, I've been able to do non-traditional things for my entire life. I know tons of people who are totally happy pursuing something they're passionate about. And this whole idea that, you know, life isn't fair or you're going to have to do bad things, it's just such a joke. I don't know how anyone can say that with a straight face.
I actually have and will send to you. I can't believe I have this stuff still. My sister found it in my mother's attic when she cleaned it out and sent it to me. I have some letters that I've scanned. They're on the Freedom Fiend site on my bio. They're linked. They're about five letters that are like school reports from 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. From me, from
I think I've seen those.
from the public school up to the public school suggesting I leave the public school to, you know, stuff in the private school. And they're basically like, you know, I mean, my testing on the Regents is like top 99 percentile. And, you know, my grades are C's and D's, except the things I'm interested in. and I didn't respect authority for some reason.
Yeah, imagine that. Well, have you heard of oppositional defiant disorder?
Have you heard the ad we did for oppositional defiant disorder?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so.
I'm going to play that for you at the break.
Okay.
Let's take a break now. I'll play it for you.
Sure.
Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin. Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this.
Quit telling me what to do!
To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
Yo.
Yo, dude, that was really, really funny.
Was it? Yeah. I mean, that's a thing I could talk about for hours is psych meds and, probably don't want to talk about it for hours, but you know.
Yeah, we're sticking with the negative if we get into
that. I know, man.
They're obviously wrong. we can stop there. The only thing I'll say is regarding ADHD, because I get calls from parents who are like, "Do you think you can take my kid? He's ADHD." And I'm like, "Definitely. This is the camp to send your kid if he is ADHD." So, and they do awesome here. They have the best time ever. Like, ugh, it's so sad.
I mean, ADHD, you know. My answer, I mean, probably not to the parent, but my answer would be, aren't most kids, you know? I mean, it's that designation did not exist when I was a kid. And I,
no.
How old are you?
I'm 30.
Okay, I'm 47. I just missed the schools dosing kids with Ritalin or psychiatrists dosing kids with Ritalin. I definitely would have been a candidate for it. And I can't count the number of people I've met in NA meetings who are recovering drug addicts who... part of their story when they get up and tell it is, and then they gave me Ritalin when I was 9, you know?
Yep. Well, that's what I thank my parents for above all else is, you know, teachers and things were insinuating that I had some sort of issue and maybe I should get looked at or whatever, because I would, like you, I was totally bored in class, always talking to people and stirring up ruckus, mostly because I was completely unengaged by the material. And the fact that they never drugged me for that is just incredible, because that was a time where people were just, you know, worshiping the school of doctors telling people what to do. And I could have very easily been drugged. I could have been a totally different person now if they would have done that. And yikes.
They called it hyperactivity when I was a kid. I was born right between the, I was too young by about a year to have my mother been given, what was the drug that made kids have flippers?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know about that? There was a drug that they gave for like morning sickness that, you know, they gave it for 9 months and then stopped giving it when the first kid started being born. I mean, they had flippers instead of arms.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Thalidomide is called. And, you know, a few years too old for that, and then a few years too young for Ritalin. But yeah, but they definitely, I mean, they used the term hyperactive with me. That was what they called ADD or ADD back then.
Yep, exactly.
So kids, how do you raise them? What do you do? How do you make them better?
How do you make them better?
Let's not talk about the negative. Let's talk about the positive.
Well, I think, you know, what my wife and I talk about all the time, and this is sort of a Stefan Molyneux idea, is we start with the idea of, can I essentially guarantee that my child will be thankful for my intervening in his life in this way? You know, so like forcing, he uses the example of forcing kids to brush their teeth. Yeah, I think that's pretty reasonable. You know, it, looking back, having been, you know, forced or tricked into brushing your teeth is probably a better outcome than having no teeth and root canals and stuff like that, right? So you're kind of almost interventing or intervening on the kid's behalf through the aggressor that is bacteria, right? But basically everything else, you know, unless it's a supervision issue, you know, so like my wife and I are both going someplace, my son has to come. Other than that, we just don't intervene in his life. Like, he gets to choose what he does. He gets to choose how he spends his time, when he goes to bed. And he's, my son's not even two yet. And you know, we're not experts. Who knows? This could completely fail. But what we're seeing is a little kid who really responds great to us. You know, he always wants us around. We want him to at some point decide, you know, I'm lucky I have these people as parents. I want these people in my life. I don't want to move out of this house or resent them or hate their guts or, you know, and probably he'll still battle against us in some cases. You know, brain research shows that that's kind of what teenagers do. And
how old
is
your child?
He'll be two in June.
See, this is, I don't want to play devil's advocate or say anything bad.
No, play devil's advocate.
But I want to talk to you and Stefan Molyneux in, you know, 14 years when your kids are teenagers and see if it worked. And I hope it does. I mean, we're kind of seeing the first generation of kids raised by libertarians with the non-aggression principle, which is different from hippie parenting of do everything you want to do and never discipline the kid in any way, I guess. I don't know. Do you discipline, would you say?
Okay, so here's how you weigh in on that, right? As far as discipline is concerned, okay, so I talk about it like this. So one of the things, opinions I have that's really unpopular is that I think that you should be a kid's friend all the time. You start by being their friend. And a lot of people are like, you can't be a kid's friend. He's going to walk all over you. And then I'm just like, and I know you agree with this too, I don't let my friends walk all over me, you know, like when my friends are constantly late for things or, you know, take mooching off me or something, I don't just let them do that. You know why? Because they're my friends and we're equals and I expect them to treat me as I treat them. And if they don't, then there are consequences with my friends just like there would be with a child. And so, you know, I guess it depends what you mean by discipline, but like I don't let my kid pull my hair or take my cereal out of my bowl or do anything like that because I don't want him to. That's aggressing against me, right? So as far as like strict discipline is concerned, I mean, that might be a bridge we cross when we come to it, but it's more like, you know, I recognize that I'm in control of the resources in the house. I'm willing to share my resources for all sorts of things, but I'm not going to share certain resources with him if he's going to use them to hurt me, you know, like, or hurt someone else, like give him a knife if he's going to stab someone. But I'm trying to envision a scenario where I need to use like timeout or.
Well, I'm thinking about a family friend who was a hippie and an educator, you know, kind of like fan of Summerhill. And,
sure.
You know, I was around this family a lot. And I mean, I remember the kid being 5 years old and calling his grandmother a bitch at the dinner table. And the mother saying, now that's not very nice. Please don't do that. And, you know, at 15, the kid was like, you know, starting fires and you know, being violent and had, you know, they ended up like shipping him off to an alternative school in a different nation because it was the only option left that would take him. And he did kind of, I guess the word is straighten out, you know, by 18 or 19. But, you know, the kid was not pleasant to be around. And I always blamed it on the do whatever you want to do upbringing.
Yeah, well, and once again, you know, the non-aggression principle, as I think you and I understand it, is not so much that you just let someone aggress on you because you abide by this or aggress on other people. Like I've intervened. So for instance, when Oliver was younger, he did pull hair. You know, he pulled my wife's hair and he pulled young girl's hair. He just did. He was like one. He didn't know better. So I would remove him from that situation because I don't want him aggressing against other people. They don't deserve it. And I don't tolerate that behavior. If I saw someone pulling someone's hair on the street, I wouldn't tolerate that behavior, you know? So we really don't let him do anything that hurts other people or hurts himself. But on the same token, and likewise, if he, like, for instance, when he screams in my face, you know, he doesn't do this very often anymore. But when he screams at me, I don't play with him. I'll get up and I'll walk away and I'll tell him, Oliver, I don't like when you scream at me. And if you're going to scream at me, I'm not going to play. And so he doesn't do it anymore, you know?
And yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is, I understand that and it sounds sensible to me. And the parent I'm talking about did not know about the non-aggression principle. She's someone who thinks, you know, the government should steal a lot more money to pay teachers better kind of person. And that the, you know, get rid of the Republicans and the Democrats will make the world a paradise and enforce right. all the proper social justice laws. But I guess the thing, the difference is like with a friend, you know, I've had friends that are unmanageable, I guess I would say, and I stopped sure. being their friends. But you can't do that mm-hmm. with your kid, you know?
It depends what you mean by you can't do that with your kid. I mean, I think that
I have a moral
obligation to care for my child
right.
until, you know, he can care for himself for sure. But, you know, and certainly as a sort of a worst case scenario thing, I hear what you're saying and that ultimately you could be pushed to a point where you have to decide, do I not want to care for this person anymore because they're aggressing against me so much? But I think that a lot of that comes from parents who do take an unprincipled approach. Like one thing I observe all the time is a parent who will be super lenient and then snap at some point, or they'll be yeah. super lenient to the point where they let their kids curse at them or yell at them. And I don't have any intention of doing that. And I think the cool thing, the advantage that Taylor and I have are I've worked with kids, primarily teenagers, for the last 15 years of my life. You know, I've seen how this works on a 1 week basis. I've seen radical transformations in how kids interact with me in a matter of 3 or 4 days. Because basically, you know, how I explain it to people is this. If you met someone and all they did was tell you how awesome you are and how much they wanted to be your friend, how much they love you, and how much they care about you, and all they did was like be excited about things, and then at some point they came to you and said, hey, I'm really concerned because you're not treating me very well, or you're not treating this other person well, you would listen to that person, right? Like this person has established themselves yeah. as a credible person you want to be around.
Yep.
Now on the flip side, if someone is constantly, you know, speaking in your ear about this or that, they're not going to listen to you. You know, they're a non-credible person. And I don't, like kids, I get parents who warn me about their kids. You're not going to be able to deal with Sean. He's going to give you a hard time. He hates adults. He specifically hates men. His dad walked out on him, blah, blah, blah. And the kid is, you know, following me around wanting to play with me 24/7 within 2 days, you know? So I'm not sure. I'm not too worried about
it. Are you magic? Are you magical?
Well, I think so. Because I think it comes down to this. Like, you know, I really believe in self-betterment. Like, I think that, you know, there's a book by Carol Dweck called Mindsets, which deals with the idea of having a fixed versus a growth mindset. I think that any person is capable of growing out of whatever mindset they have, given enough time. And I think that there are very extreme cases, I guess, you know, where there's physiological damage to a person's brain or something. But I think in most cases you can grow. And I've worked my ass off to try and get to the point where I can engage with people in a peaceful and exciting and, you know, a thoughtful and, you know, a listening way. And I work harder at it every day. I constantly self-assess on it. And the thing is, most adults set the bar so low for kids that you don't even have to work that hard at it to get them to love you. You know, like most kids approach me and they're wary because they're like, oh, here comes an adult. Adults are the worst. All they do is tell you that you're not good enough, or if they do praise you, it's for something you have no control over, like being good at sports or school. And here's this guy who just wants to hang out and tells me I'm awesome for being me. And, you know, when he encourages me, it's because I'm doing things that I do have control over, like being nice or being generous or being loving. And so, yeah, it's, I don't know if I have a magic bullet, but it certainly works for me.
Wow. Kids. That's the topic today here on the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. We're talking about kids, and the call-in number is, I don't know, what you said was so soothing to me, I kind of like lost my train of thought. Maybe you are magical.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I have this theory that about six, well, it's another person's theory that I subscribe to and receive their newsletter, that 6% of all humans are sociopaths, broken machines who cannot be fixed. You don't seem to feel that way, do you?
Yeah, well, it depends, you know. So the way I pose this scenario to people is I do think that everyone is born in a certain way. And certainly, I think a physiological or genetic issue can inhibit yourself from growing to the point where you are a loving and peaceful person. But I think most people sort of start developing a shell about the time when adults really start intervening in their lives. And they start to recognize that there are central planners out there who are trying to be their puppet master, you know? And what I've observed in kids is the older they get, the thicker the shell becomes. And so kindergartners, I can convince a kindergartner to run and scream with me or cover themselves in mud and go crazy and just have a blast in one minute, right? But like a 17-year-old, it might take me 3 whole days. But you know what? If you check, I can send you some pictures sometime. I've gotten like a really cool story was this guy who came to my old camp who was, he was a 17-year-old kid. He was a black kid in a primarily white camp, you know, from Newark, which is a really tough area. And he got there and he was just, you know, just straight up hood the whole time. You know, he wouldn't be involved in any of the fun, wouldn't sing any songs. And I was like, this is really a test. I'm going to get through to this kid. And so by Friday night, he finally let loose at this campfire and was singing these insane songs. And the next year he returned for our counselor and training program. And then he wound up being a counselor at that camp and being the craziest kid at the whole camp because his shell was super thick, you know, growing up in a single parent household, and he was really overweight, and I know he got teased all the time and stuff, but his shell was just mad thick, and we had to get through it. But once we were there, he was like, ah, I'm free. And so I think the really problematic thing becomes when people build a shell their whole life, and then they become adults, and then they start enacting the force on other people, then it can become super, super tough. Because they also have skin in the game now, you know, like they start doing this to other people. They don't want to hear that they're aggressors or anything like that. So that can be really challenging. And I've had much less success with adults than I have with kids for sure.
I saw a news item yesterday. It's a current news item, on CNN or something about some, gay black teenage boy who is in public school and was being relentlessly bullied for being gay and being beat up, and the school wasn't doing anything about it. And his mother sent him to school with a stun gun. I was like, right on, man. I don't know if you'd feel right on, but I was like, fuck yeah. And you know, the kid didn't shock anybody with it. It was just the next time the bullies came around and surrounded him and were about to punch him, he pulled it out and just shocked it in the air and they ran off. And of course the kid got arrested and kicked out of school, and you know, prominent psychiatrists are being consulted. But I was like, yeah, what do you think of that story?
Well, I think, well, here's my opinion on this. So, you know, I'm talking to my brother, who's a Buddhist. He talks about how the Buddhist ideals are of learning compassion and wisdom, you know, like, and you have to have a perfect balance of each. And I think that I totally agree. You know, I try to lead my life in compassionate ways, but you know, like the extreme of just being compassionate without being wise is like selling yourself as a slave to someone for free, right? Like I could just follow someone around hand and foot, give them all the products of my labor and just be being so nice. But that would be really unwise use of my time. I can help far more people by trying to spread messages of liberty and interacting with kids. And so being a slave would be a terrible idea. And so if I were constantly having to go to an environment where I was being abused and beat up, I would definitely think it would be wise to be able to defend myself against them, and whatever means necessary, you know, that's in someone's own heart, but I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, of any story I've heard of a kid carrying a weapon to school, it seems like the most clear cut self-defense I've ever heard of, you know, and even non-lethal self-defense. Like whenever you hear about a kid bringing a weapon to school, it's usually either, you know, he brought a nail clipper or brought a toy soldier holding a little plastic rifle and they kick him out of school, or it's a kid bringing a gun to school to shoot him. Those are like that's the two stories you hear about. I've rarely heard about a kid bringing a non-lethal weapon for pure self-defense to a school. And of course they dealt with it like they deal with either of the others, but
yeah. Well, and you know, I think I have a kind of a unique perspective on this actually, because I was actually stabbed by a guy in high school. When I was in ninth grade. Yeah. And it was a guy I went to a really mixed racial high school. And this guy was a guy who I played basketball with in high school or in middle school and stuff. And I walked out of health class one day and he hit me on the arm, and I turned around and hit him back on the arm saying kind of like, what's up? You know how guys do. And he, all of a sudden I hear guys behind him be like, oh snap, white boy snuck him. What's up? What's up? And I was like, oh, this isn't going well. So I started just walking away, and I saw the people like kind of walking towards me, like just looking on horrified. So I spun around right at the right second, and he was coming at me with a knife. So I was able to get my arm in the way. He was kind of going for my midsection. And I kind of, I don't know, blocked it, but I still got stabbed, you know, all the way through my forearm. And he kind of snapped out of it in that moment. He's like, dude, there's a knife in your arm, you know? And with the next heartbeat, you know, just kind of spray of blood against the lockers. And he actually kind of threw the knife down and ran me to the nurse, you know? But there's this thing in play where it's a microcosm of our society's view on guns, which is that, you know, when you have a place with no weapons, mean people bring weapons there and take from people, right? So schools are the ultimate example of that. Kids like me were never going to bring a weapon to school. But if I might have had one, I think he might have thought twice about running and trying to stab me, you know? So I don't know what the answer is, because kids are also, their brains aren't fully formed. So I don't know if they should have lethal weapons or whatever, but I certainly can never blame someone for wanting to defend themselves, because I lived in fear for 2 years plus after that, and it might have been avoidable.
My brother in the 60s used to bring a .22 rifle to school on the bus, not in a case, just over his shoulder, for a Boy Scout rifleman class that was taught at the school after school. He would bring this gun to school on the school bus and stick it in his locker and lock it. He didn't have the bullets. They had the bullets. But, you know, can you imagine that now?
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So, yeah, my brother brought a gun to school often.
Yeah, I don't think he would be able to get away with that anymore, Michael.
Mm-mm. Nope. And they'd send him to a shrink and give him compliacin.
Yeah, heavy dose on that one for sure. That's a strong case of ODD right there.
So do you teach archery? Speaking of weapons, do you teach archery at your camp?
Yeah, actually. We hold archery typically twice a week, but we'll offer it more if there are kids that are interested.
Period.
Do you want to hear more about
it? Yeah, I like archery.
Okay, yeah, so we do teach archery. I mean, basically, you know, our stance on it is that we're essentially teaching kids to use these dangerous tools. You know, it's also fun, builds confidence, and it's a cool thing they don't get to do elsewhere. But I think that the most interesting thing about it for me is that insurance companies don't even really mind archery, because at camps, kids don't get hurt doing archery, even though they're shooting, you know, what basically could be lethal weapons. And, you know, we have 6-year-olds do it, 17-year-olds do it. We have kids on pain medication do it, and ADD medication, you know, every kid does it. But the thing is, when you tell them how serious it is and you show them how to use it right, and you explain to them that they won't be able to use it if they don't use it right, they're 100% responsible. There's never a single incident of anyone goofing around at the archery course. Yeah, it's like it's probably the safest activity that we run.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that people think that kids could never do that I think they can do. You know, I think that kids can definitely handle weapons with supervision, you know, even guns with supervision. I mean, I was shooting my dad's .22 when I was 16. Sure. I never hurt anybody except a bunny rabbit, which we cooked and ate, which remains the only thing I've ever hunted. I live in this hunter's paradise of Wyoming. I've been here 3 years and I haven't, you know, gone and taken an antelope yet, but it's on the to-do list. And I do have a belief that if you're going to shoot something, you should eat it. I mean, I don't know if it's a moral thing or just a, you know, it makes sense. But, you know, when the world ends, I don't even know if I'll have to hunt. I think there's so many pigeons in my yard, I could hunt with a blanket.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's my thing too. You know, actually my wife and I are, practically speaking, we're vegetarians, but, we would be happy to eat meat if it were like hunted, you know, animals just running around, not being tortured first, or, you know, kind of ethically raised cows, things like that.
And from a health standpoint, the crap they put into beef chicken is unreal.
Yeah, it's not something you want to think too much about if you're a meat eater. But, you know, when we started trying to live intentionally, it's the same thing. You know, we didn't want to run around and saying, well, I'm just going to kill some stuff and, you know, I don't need to kill stuff to eat it, so I don't.
I have this coffee table book someone gave me called Armed in America, which is photos of families all over the country with their guns in their living room and a short paragraph from each one describing it. And, you know, it's got everything from, you know, bodyguards to militia types to target shooters to, you know, housewives who carry a, you know, snubby revolver in their purse for self-defense to, you know, people that have more guns than I have cats, which is a lot of guns, to One guy who was really interesting was, it was a guy who lived in California, and he was like, I'm a Democrat. I've always hated guns, but I'm a chef. And so I decided to hunt to, you know, be able to cook my own meat that I've taken myself. I really liked that attitude. It was interesting to me.
Oh, definitely. I think that's kind of like, you know, that's my thing about just eating meat in general, is it's like, you know, just man up. If you want to eat a cow, great, eat a cow, but know where your cow comes from. Don't just sit with your blinders on and think that it's all, you know, this happy paradise. Like, your cow is probably coming from this wall-to-wall thing where they're all standing in their own feces and eating their own feces and, you know, 60% attrition rate before they actually get to the butcher's knife and stuff. But yeah, that's my only thing.
Not in Wyoming. In Wyoming, they're free roaming. I mean, I don't know that they're not organic, but, you know, you drive around Wyoming and there are vast stretches in this state where, you know, you don't see a person for 30 minutes and you see thousands of cattle grazing on the plains. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, and that's cool. You know, I think that making use of our resources to feed human beings is a great thing to do. And if your land is better suited to grazing cattle, or you don't have the time to raise whatever else, and or you can make money off it, go for it. You know,
well, why
the torture thing is bad for me.
Wyoming could feed and power America, although I'm afraid what it would look like if they noticed that and started to take full advantage of it. I mean, literally, between wind, solar, oil, natural gas, coal, and uranium, Wyoming could literally power America, and we'd never have to drop a bomb on a brown person again. But, you know, I mean, it's a combination of weird forces. It's like, you know, ultra liberal Democrats who are like, I don't want to drill for oil in America or use nuclear power. So they go do those things in other countries, which involves killing a lot of people.
You know?
I mean, this state is giant. It's like the size of Utah, and it's got a half million people in it.
I loved Wyoming. I drove through there and stayed in Yellowstone and Devil's Tower, and it was one of the coolest places ever.
Yeah, sure. I live in Casper, which is looks like a small town. It's 50,000 people. It's the second biggest town in the state. It looks like the small town in Western New York I grew up in. I mean, I'm looking out my window, I feel like I'm in Westfield, New York. But you know, you go 5 miles out of town in any direction, and it looks like the moon with sagebrush. I mean, it's weird to me coming from LA, where, you know, you leave town and there's always just another town over the hill or another city. Yeah. And here you leave town and there is empty. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I dig that too. That's like the new place I live too, because I came from the suburbs in New Jersey. So it's a breath of fresh air to be a country boy now.
So my audience with what I do, based on the emails we get, tends to be about 99% male, disaffected males between the ages of 17 and 30. And the people you work with, your clients seem to be like, what is it, 5 to 17?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you line them up, we'll knock them down. You start them out and we'll take them from there. But I was thinking about the horizontal enforcement idea, you know, the idea of the Ben Quaker and a few other people have said that, you know, the government is the thing with the buildings and the gun, the men with the guns and the salaries and the laws, but that's not really what enforces things. The state is what enforces things, and the state is people. It's the horizontal enforcement. It's, you know, it's the person who sees someone who got away somehow with not paying their taxes and says, you know, they should be in a cage. And it's the person who is on the jury for the nonviolent crime and votes guilty to, you know, ruin someone's life for a little bag of herbs. And it's the person who says, well, I'm rich and I have no problem paying my taxes, so everyone else should pay their taxes. And, you know, it's the person who says, you know, support our troops when the troops, even though the troops, they don't care if the troops are doing things immoral and they don't even like what the troops are doing, but they say, you know, we got to support our president. We got to support our troops. That's the state. All of that is the state.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I mean, basically in history, there's four ways governments have changed for the better or the worse, or let's say for the better. Armed revolutions, which is completely out the window. It worked 200 and some years ago because it was a bunch of farmers and a bunch of you know, bodyguards from the king, and the king was, right, you know, a three-week boat ride away and couldn't send more enforcements, and now they would just fucking drone you. You know, yeah, there's voting, which they, you know, I like the old thing of if voting changed anything, it'd be illegal. You can't change things by voting.
I never heard that. That's great.
And then there's education. And I think that educating people is the only solution at this point, because the other two are unworkable. You know, basically, my life goal at this point is to teach as many people as possible what the non-aggression principle is. And it is such a simple concept. I mean, it basically takes one sentence to define, to say it, and then a paragraph or two to fully explain it. I mean, you could literally explain it to a five-year-old, yet so many adults have such a problem with it and will argue in favor of the state of, but who would take care of the children? Who would take care of the roads? And I think educating enough people, you know, and my niche is, you know, 17 to 30 year old disaffected males, and your niche is everybody between 5 and 17, male and female, whether they're disaffected or not. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think that this, and this is why I'm optimistic, and by the way, why I like you and Nima so much more than
Alex
most
Jones.
People. Yeah, well, just most people in the, even in the Liberty community, because they spend so much time beating the dead horse of the government. You know, like for me, when I listen to that, sometimes I do in a masochistic way, like, oh, what did they do now type of way. But
we talk about it. We have a tyranny today at least once an episode.
Oh, no, definitely. But, and I think it's worth pointing out, because you don't want people, especially like for you guys, you know, you get a new listener who might not be on board. You do need to go through it. So I definitely don't begrudge anyone doing it. But just for me, like if someone were making a show directly for me, it would look more like what you guys are doing versus something like, you know, I don't want to use anyone specifically as an example, but just a more negatively geared show. Now, you have to do the negative, especially if you have a huge audience, because a lot of people need to be convinced that they're.
I mean, basically, that was a conscious decision. It was like, Neem and I listened to every single libertarian podcast and video. We've watched something by every single person that does this. And I listen to the LRN feed and, you know, listen to them constantly in the background, like the way liberals listen to NPR. You know, it's a 24-hour streaming feed of it's my liberal NP, my anarcho-capitalist NPR. And I hear whenever there's like a big tyranny going on that a lot of people that people notice, I hear 12 podcasts in a row and 11 of them talk about that single event. So, you know, early on, we learned to kind of get away from that and just laugh at the state instead and talk more about freedom and less about tyranny.
Yeah, and my thing is that basically the way I see it is that there are two eventual outcomes. You know, there's one where, or I guess three. One is that we blow up the whole world, but then there is, beyond that, there's either a stable tyranny, like the dystopian Brave New World type future, you know, which you could argue that given the existence of drones now, that becomes increasingly likely. And then there's libpair, right? Because if you're going to do the stable tyranny, they would have to be good at what they do in order to achieve that. And I just don't trust that they're good enough because they screw up everything else. And, you know, they manage tyranny pretty well, but they're just kind of screw ups. So I'm not too concerned about that. So then the other thing is that eventually we'll probably get to libertarian paradise. And I think the way we get there, and so that's why I don't bother, you know, worrying about drones and things like that. Because, you know, if they start droning people, I think they'll probably lose eventually. But yeah, so I'm trying to think, so what's the fastest way we could get people to just interact with each other peacefully, show love for each other? And for me, that's interacting with kids and just treating them that way. And when they wonder, what was so different about that guy? You know, why was he, why were those staff members at that camp or school, hopefully someday too, what was different about them? And we'll tell them, you know, it's because we don't believe in initiating force against peaceful people. And we also believe to go even further than that is to show, you know, radical love towards every person you meet, regardless of how they're hanging out. And I see kids just turn, they totally get it in the camp environment. And that's where it starts for me. My hope is that when they encounter, you know, information like yours, that they won't scoff at it. They might think, this reminds me an awful lot of the way that person was treating me, who treated me the best of anyone who's ever interacted with me. And it's all small scale, right? But I do know that there are people out there and that the movement is growing. And whether it happens in my lifetime or just someday, I think we'll win, man. Because I just don't think people can look themselves in the mirror forever and continue to do these bad things to people.
Is that your closing comment? Is that your final answer?
Well, not quite. I think the last thing that I want to leave people with is the whole other reason for optimism is if you look back in time, any amount of time, if you look back in time 15 years ago, no one had ever heard of like organic food, for instance. And the people who had were like, what is going on here? Why does everyone want to eat chemicals? And, you know, we should offer organic food. And everyone just, no one even laughed at them because no one even knew they existed, right? And now it's this burgeoning movement where tons of people want to try it and whatever else. Because, you know, in my opinion, it's a pretty good idea. I certainly don't think anyone should be forced to do it, but it's probably a good idea to not eat synthetic chemicals. But it's a good idea, so ultimately it wins. And likewise with treating black people fairly, you know. 50 years ago, you would get laughed at the street if you heard someone saying, oh, black people are just the same as white people. But now, basically no one in the U.S. thinks that, except for the really fringy kind of crazy people. And that's why I really think that you and I might be shocked, Michael. We might be having this discussion 30 years from now, and people might look back at now and say, can you believe people used to pay taxes to go kill other people? That's shocking.
I don't know. I feel that sometimes, and then other times I feel, you know, you and I are going to be talking through the bars in a government reindoctrination camp about how it used to be in whispering.
Oh, but they'll never find us, Michael. They'll go get Ian and those guys first, and I guess you know they might get you.
They'll get me. I'd like to think I'm big enough to be a target.
You are. But no, they're not gonna. And the thing is, they'll try, but they'll get you first, and then at some point, everyone else will stand up and say, "Hold on a second. I know this Michael Dean guy, and he might have weird ideas, but he's not dangerous. You can't lock this guy up." And I think that even if you guys all have to be martyrs.
The problem with making people into martyrs, you know, so.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I think they would go after someone like me because they don't want to go after Alex Jones because he's too well known.
Yeah, that's probably true. And they, you know, they might even just say, hey, we found guns in Michael Dean's house. And everyone would go, oh, no wonder you arrested him.
Well, but, there are over a dozen guns in Michael Dean's house, and they're all legal, and there'd be no problem.
Yeah, the newspapers don't care about that, though. Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, but yeah, so you're right. And I think that the stable tyranny future is totally plausible. You know, I would not deny that that's a plausibility. But like from my perspective, you know, coming from the background of dealing in probability, which is, you know, how I made my living forever, is I just don't think that probabilistically speaking that that's a very likely outcome. And now it may appear to be likely. And I think you guys just talked about this recently, didn't you, about the idea that the less tyranny you start with, the longer your state will last.
Nemo was quoting Stefan or Bad Quaker, yeah, exactly. I forget which.
Yeah. And I think that sort of makes sense. But I think it's so easy to have observation bias, which is to say, I live at this period in time. Cell phones will never have computers on them, or I live in this period in time, and black people will never vote, or whatever. And, you know, who knows, man? Stable tyranny is possible. I'm not sweating it.
An interesting thing about all that is when you mentioned the vast changes that have happened when people finally woke up about things like eating healthy and not being racist, the immediate, when people get religious about something that's important, and those are very important things, and people got religious about them, their first stop is, we need the government to use its guns to solve this. And libertarianism is about just about the only thing I can think of that people get religious about where the concept isn't, we need the government guns to enforce this, it's, we need the government guns to go away.
That's probably a good point. And I wonder if it'll work, because certainly the government has expedited some of these other movements, right? Like civil liberties or even eating healthy, like having to post about trans fat or Surgeon General's warning and all that stuff. But I do think that good ideas win. And I believe in the market, you know, and I think that ultimately, even though there are these bad forces in the market, that the market will someday shove governments out somewhere. And then once they shove them out somewhere, those places will thrive. And I don't know. Maybe I'm the only person that's more optimistic than you and Nima, but that's okay.
I think you're more you're around Nima's optimism. I vacillate between optimism and wondering whether, you know, when I'm an old man, whether America is going to look like Brave New World or whether it's going to look like what's the one where they eat people made of crackers and everyone's starving? Soylent Green.
Yeah, right.
You know, whether it's going to be a functional dystopia where, you know, everyone's employed and everyone's controlled by the state, and they tell you, you know, who to breed with or even breed you in laboratories, and the state raises your kid, but you get to take some drugs and have some sex and it's encouraged, or whether it's going to be mass starvation in the streets and food riots.
And I get low moments too. I mean, especially regarding the drones in particular. And I know you guys joke about those, but those are really the ultimate for me in terms of like that could be the last brick to fall. And then if you get a truly evil set of dudes and an army to follow them. But I mean, I guess I come from an optimistic point of view because I happen to live someplace right now where I essentially live free. You know, our business isn't taxed. We bring in and our business is now thriving based on, you know, the way we're interacting with people in a peaceful and loving and excited way. And, you know, everything is going so well for us there. And I get to live in this community all summer long where no one's aggressing against each other. And the only modest force that's ever used is on people's behalf to defend them and stuff. And just how fast kids get it. And so I know it's just a microcosm, but I guess it just energizes me and it makes me see that it's possible. But I don't know how it'll happen someday. Maybe we could start a not-for-profit liberty community and tell the government something. I don't know what we would do, but I don't know. It gives me energy thinking about it.
Well, redneck patriots always tell me, if you don't like America, get out. And I'm like, cool, where do I go? You know, there's nowhere to go. There's a state everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
maybe
that's the straw man too, because yeah, there's plenty of states that are way worse than ours, right? So aren't we so lucky? But I don't know. That is a good question. I don't know where we go.
I don't know where we go. Nima always says the moon, but I don't know if I can get there in my lifetime. All right, man.
You can do seasteading or join the Free State Project, you know, but yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. My wife and I are a nation of two, and our cats are our militia.
Yeah, but I've seen your house, Michael. It's not a windowless bunker. So.
It is not. It's a nice little suburban house with a cute little fenced-in backyard where my cat can play all day in the sun.
Yeah, right on, dude.
All right, man. Good stuff.
Yeah, thanks for the time, man. Someday we'll have to talk about punk rock, as I grew up a punk rocker, and we got a whole host of stuff to catch up on sometime, but
excellent.
This was good times.
We'll have you back in 6 months. All right, man. Thanks.
Right on, brother.
Worms.
Worms.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiend show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.fm streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.